Oh, I forgot this one. Turn this one on. Okay. I read a little bit about, a little bit from this essay and then make some more comments and we can have some discussion. I do with my glasses. This is a little bit like... See?
Yeah.
This is like being at home. Where's my glasses? I'm going to read the opening two paragraphs and then a few sentences. So not a lot of reading. Instruction for the Tenzo, and I should also mention, Tenzo is a Japanese word that means the head cook at a monastery. So that's what the Tenzo is. He's the head cook at the monastery. Zen monasteries have traditionally had six officers who all are Buddha's disciples and all share Buddha's activities. Among them, the Tenzo is responsible for preparing meals for the monks. The regulations state, quote, in order to make reverential offerings to monks, there is a position called Tenzo, end quote. Since ancient times, this position has been held by accomplished monks who have way-seeking mind or by senior disciples with an aspiration for enlightenment. This is so because the position requires wholehearted practice. And this is actually probably of the numerous points in this essay, instructions too, probably the biggest point he wants to make, and that is that cooking is practice. And that dedicated, wholehearted, concentrated effort for doing cooking is practice. It's not something subservient to Zazen or something else, chanting. It is practice. So that's that reinforces my bumper sticker idea. So cooking is practice if you do it with wholehearted activity. Those without way-seeking mind will not have good results in spite of their efforts. The regulations for the Zen monastery state, quote, use your way-seeking mind carefully to vary the menus from time to time and offer the great assembly ease and comfort. Long ago, great teachers like Yishan and Dongshan and others held this position. So he wants to make sure the people reading this and the intended audience are monks in a monastery, know that this is not a trivial thing. It's not just a cook. This is a great practice. Then he adds a sentence, this work is surely not the same as the work of worldly cooks and imperial cooks and the like. And I want to come back to this sentence a little bit later. But first I want to pick out a few highlights of this essay. There's quite a bit of instruction, some general, some very specific. Some just simple phrases are keep yourself harmonious and wholehearted. I think you can, that's, you could put that on a bumper sticker also. That's short enough. You can fit that on a bumper sticker. Keep yourself harmonious and wholehearted. Here's another nice quotation. In the art of cooking, the essential consideration is to have a deeply sincere mind, regardless of the fineness or coarseness of the materials. So don't complain if the cabbage is getting a little old, just give it everything you got. One of the things Dogen is well known for in his philosophy, I'm sure many of you have heard this many times, is he talks about practice enlightenment. And that practice and enlightenment are not separate activities. I thought this is a nice sentence that just restates his position. If you have the spirit of not dwelling in the realm of right and wrong, How can this not be the practice of directly entering unsurpassable wisdom? So, I don't know how many of his essays have this, but his idea of practice enlightenment is definitely part of this. Then here's a quotation that made me really think about the golden rule. We've heard about the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You've probably heard that. So I thought this was pretty close to it 8 centuries ago. You should understand that there are foolish people who do not take care of themselves because they do not take care of others. And there are wise people who care for others just as they care for themselves. In the last section of the essay, it begins with this sentence. In performing your duties along with the other officers and staff, you should maintain joyful mind, kind mind, and great mind. And then he goes on to describe what he means by these three kinds of minds. And it's really a lovely part of the essay if you're interested in reading it. But I'm not going to do it tonight because it may take a bit longer. But it's a lovely end to the essay. Joyful mind, kind mind, and great mind. Well, I want to come back, not to be kind of a nitpicking, but I have a point I want to make about this negative statement here at the end of his introduction, which he says, this work is surely not the same as the work of worldly cooks. Well, he certainly didn't mean that if you're not in a monastery, you can't practice, you can't be enlightened. He's just kind of taking a little bit of a swipe at people outside the monastery walls, if you will. Maybe a bit of a gratuitous insult or what have you. But who knows what the cooks were like 8 centuries ago in medieval Japan. They might have been quite a lot to be near. But so when we read Dogen, you know, we should, I think, obviously keep him in context. Remember that his audience are monks in Japanese monasteries in medieval Japan. That's who he's writing for. 8 centuries have passed. So we just kind of keep that in context. But that's a minor point I wanted to make about the negative comment about not worldly cooks. The bigger issue that made me think about it is negativity in general and how it's very easy to take on negativity and believe it, internalize it. So we might read that and might think, well, maybe I can't do this practice, or I'm not good enough for this practice. So, you know, when we paper over reality with our thoughts and our feelings, it isn't just that we paper them over with thoughts and feelings. They're generally negative thoughts and feelings, or often negative thoughts and feelings that come up for us. And I want to talk about that for just a few minutes. So we have self-doubt, self-criticism. We think, I don't understand, I'll never be enlightened, I'm not old enough, I'm too young, I'm too old, I'm too poor, I'm not handsome or pretty enough, I'm too old, too young, I said that, didn't I? I'm too fat or too thin, all those things which just aren't right, you know? I'm just not right. I can't quite do it, I'm just not good enough. So we have these things that go on. And we forget the positive a lot of times, and just somehow this negative just keeps circling around. Maybe even in Zazen, those things are coming up, and outside of Zazen too. Well, one thing I wanted to say is, it's not bad to have negative thoughts. In fact, they're normal, natural even. It's even natural to have negative thoughts. And kind of, I think about, you know, why is that? And I think about two sources. One is, you could describe as a survival instinct. So imagine, you know, how our brains work, how we evolved over time. Imagine you're 100,000 years ago, sitting around a camp, and you suddenly hear some noise in the bushes. You don't think, gee, that might be a pretty bird, I'll go take a look. You think, that could be a lion, I'm going to get my spear. That's how we're built. That's how our brains are built. And we're actually wired that way. We're wired to survive. And that spills over in our thinking a lot of times. We're built to think of the worst possibility. Survival instinct is also, you know, there's a saying we have sometimes, we say before breakfast, greed is a source of delusion. And even greed, I thought about greed. It's a kind of a perversion of survival instinct. And I was thinking of people who want to, you know, there's all kinds of forms of greed. People want materials, they want whatever services, they want money, great food. And I thought about greed, the thought occurred to me about the animal kingdom, and how some animals, and the male of the species, they fight, and one dominates an area, and then they get a harem. They get a harem out of their activities, all these female animals of the same species. And I thought, well, gee, is that greedy? Now, how would we think about that in some land that maybe still exists in some small corner of the world where a man wants to have a harem of women? So I just thought of it as a kind of a, it's not evil, it's a kind of a perversion of an instinct to survive. You want more. The more you have, the more protected you are, the more likely you are to survive, the more likely your offspring will do well, and you'll be comfortable. You won't starve to death. So a lot of these things come from animal instincts and how we're wired. Even blood, it made me think about blood proteins. So in blood proteins, to be kind of objective about it, things you can really measure, the most abundant proteins in our blood, most abundant is albumin, which is an important carrier protein. We won't worry about that. Second most abundant protein are immunoglobulins. These are proteins that defend ourselves against infection. There's a lot of immunoglobulins in our bloodstream because our bodies are constantly on the defensive for infection. And if you think about that, when someone dies, the blood quits flowing. It doesn't take long for the corpse to smell as the bacteria grow very, very quickly. So our bodies need this kind of defense constantly. And that's how we're built, not just in our blood, but also in our brains. We have this tendency to think the negative, basically from survival instinct. But there's another thing. So that's the past. You can say, well, I blame my ancestors. 100,000 years ago, they built me this way. But there's things that happen in our lifetime, not just that we inherit. There's trauma. So when we think about trauma survivors, we think of all kinds of situations. And some people think of really horrendous things, which are, you're at war and bombs are going off and you're wounded and so on and so forth. Trauma can be incredibly horrific, But how much trauma do most all of us face in one way or another at some time or another? So I was talking to a psychologist friend of mine. He said he thought that about 90% of people are trauma survivors. And I should have quizzed him how he measured that, but I thought about it. I didn't, but I thought about it. And then I thought some more, and I thought, well, of course, it depends on how you define the word, but maybe it's closer to 100%. Maybe it's closer to 100% that all of us have had trauma of one form or another. Whether it's an assault, like you normally think of trauma, but you lose a loved one. You lose a relationship. You lose a job. You're in a car accident. There are all kinds of things that happen in our lives, which at some level I think are legitimately called trauma. So we get a lot of negativity. And it's not our fault. And it's not abnormal. And it's not something we should be ashamed of or say that, you know, if I were better, if I did Zazen better, this wouldn't be happening to me. That's just not how it works. So, I'm not done with survival instincts, because although they may make you grab your spear and look for the lion, they also have some positive aspects. So, for example, love. When we talk about love, we talk about wanting to be with other people. And that's a tremendous survival instinct. Very powerful one. We want to be with people. We have the Sangha in Buddhism, the community. And also between people, usually we like to have a close relationship. And that's driven by our instincts. And it's a beautiful thing. Love is a beautiful thing. And another survival instinct that we have is a desire for food. We want to eat. We need to eat. So when I think of this bumper sticker, I think of the positive survival instincts. I think of love. I think of eating tasty food in particular. And I want us also to remember Dogen, who said, dedicated, wholehearted cooking is practice enlightenment. It's not separate. It's something we can all do. It's something you can do with a five-year-old making cookies. It's something you can do all your life and with friends and people you love. So let's consider those positive aspects. Love people. Cook them tasty food. Save all sentient beings. Thank you. Any questions or comments, please?
I just want to say thank you for that very good talk. And it's a subject that it's dear to my heart, too, because I've always thought of making food for people, you know, the best food you can possibly make is being an act of love. And so when you make food, it's not just like, oh, it's a chore, I have to cook. You know, it's like, oh, what can I make that'll be really, really good? You know? So I think that's a good spirit to, you know, feed your family with or your friends. And it's a good thing. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like the tastiness because you gotta really work at it, you know? It just doesn't happen. You have to make it happen.
Creative. Try new things.
Right. Very good. Thank you. Yes, Sumar.
So, 2 days ago, KQED, they were showing this documentary about the Holocaust survivor. And there's a song, It's Now or Never. I think everybody's heard it. I think Elvis Presley sang it. But that was being played at Auschwitz when, in Italian, when people were being sent to to the gas chambers. Mm-hmm. And she talked about it, and she was talking to this other woman who was, they were sitting in a gondola after 50 years in Vegas, and this man who's, you know, the who's pushing the boat is singing that Italian, and she was saying, I can't let go of this. It just reminded me of the sadness of all the stuff that I've seen. And this woman said, no, you know, this is a song. You know, yes, this happened to us, but you can't let this define you. So what we're saying about trauma, it's interesting because the thing is, what happens to people is that people have been oppressed. It's a kind of an oppression that takes place. People have been oppressed. People have been put down. People have been treated badly. And it's, people call it, you know, it can be called colonialism, it can be called the Stockholm syndrome, where you start identifying with the oppressors, and you become like that person, even after that person is gone. So, it was such a take on the whole of the, it was such a positive spin, the way this woman was talking about the Holocaust, was just like saying to this other woman, look, I've had children, I love my children, I've had grandchildren, I love my grandchildren, I love the way that they have grown up. Yes, I went through this experience, this horrible experience. You know, I'm one of the survivors, and the rest of my family is gone. But I've lived a life. I'm happy. I'm thankful for my life. So I was thinking, this is, you know, to unhinge yourself from the experience such as that and come out of it. You know, we go through regular traumas, but going through something like that, and you can unhinge yourself and say, hey, you know, I have my life too. You know, I don't want to be sitting there. This other woman was sitting in the past. But she was saying, no, you know, you can't sit in the past. You just have to let go of it. And right. It was just amazing to watch that documentary, and I was just thinking, wow, this is like so powerful to have this kind of perspective. And just, it was just amazing. And the other thing that I wanted to say to you was, you were talking about, you know, all these negative thoughts coming up. I was thinking while you were talking about that, I said, the soil doesn't discriminate against weeds coming up or plants coming up. It just sees them as another plant, another growth that's happening. You know, the ocean doesn't discriminate against a small wave or a shore or a big wave. It's a wave that happens and goes away. I think it's also how much attention we put on something is very important. If we put the emphasis on negative or positive too. You know. So that in itself, when you start looking at things that way, I think it starts to shift your perspective as how you see the world.
Thank you. Yeah, the human spirit is great. It can overcome a lot of obstacles, a lot of trauma. Some people get captured by it, don't escape it. Some people do. And that's why it's good to keep that positive, right? Keep that positive. Keep going. I think one of the nicest people I ever met was a stepfather, my sister-in-law. And he had a number tattooed right here, showed me. Serial number from the camp he was in. And it always amazed me how nice he was. He was just the nicest guy, you know. Always had a kind word. His demeanor was so nice. So it reminds me of the story you're telling me. You know, but it's also, I wanted to make a point that when negative stuff comes up, it's not weird. We're not weird. We're not bad. And then it is okay to let it go, especially when you realize that I'm not defective. I'm just human. And so I think that was part of it. Thank you.
Well, experienced something like this where on the job site where sometimes I'll bring coffee for my subs. And so, my painter and I were working on the job, and he shared his lunch with me, a sandwich, and, or half a sandwich, which is very kind, you know. And then I thought, well, it's my turn, you know. So I said, I'll bring lunch tomorrow. So I bought stuff. I tried to make as best I can, you know, and tasty. And for Tom and for his helper, I noticed it changed the whole atmosphere of the job, the whole, you know, feeling. It was a vacant house, so the customers weren't there. So it was just us working, and just kind of put a more positive feeling. And so, and you can't get that from fast food. It's like that food doesn't have any soul. It's just made like an assembly line, like a factory, where if you make something by hand, that's where the nutrition comes from, the making of it. It's not just the food, it's the activity. There's some magic involved, maybe. Anyway, so I completely agreed with the bumper sticker and with your talk. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, breaking bread with people. That's a saying. That's a good saying, right? Yes, Anna.
When you brought up negativity in the context of food, I immediately thought of when you have a good meal, but you quickly start thinking, if I just had this to go with it, like a good tomato soup, but you want some bread or grilled cheese to go with it, and you get that spin of, what if, or if it had a little more seasoning, or I want this, and you spin it, and then if someone says that and you offer to take it away from them, of course they say, no, I'll have it. Just, no, don't take it from me. And I think that this practice, both in the preparation of food and while you're having it, to watch those thoughts and those habits we have in our life, I think there's a lot to be learned with our relationship with food and in our own life about what our mind is.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, what did you call it?
Oh, well, I got like a wheat bread, and I toasted it with ham and spicy mustard and arugula and some fruit and candy for dessert. No, just like, and then also made some peanut butter jelly sandwich. But if you toast the bread, it's much better that way, in my opinion.
Yes, please.
I'm just thinking, what is trauma?
What is karma?
Trauma.
Trauma.
What is trauma? It's so relative.
Well, trauma, general definition would be something terrible that happens to a person. And then you could define types of trauma, like wartime trauma, automobile accident kind of trauma, anything that happens that you is a big event. Or, you know, I should say, it doesn't have to be event. Usually we think of trauma as something that happens. You could almost put a time and date on it. And that's true in a lot of cases. But there's also a kind of trauma that's worth thinking about, which isn't associated with a particular time and day. For example, when children grow up, and they don't have affection, close affection in their lives when they're growing up, that's a kind of trauma that lasts for years. So it doesn't have to be just an event, although it can be just an event, but anything really, really bad, or we perceive as really bad.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's trauma.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a kind of trauma, yeah.
But that's a trauma to that person. But if the same person goes to some other part of the world where there was war, and they've lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
They forget the job. They don't have a roof.
Right.
They don't have clothes.
Right.
And so, you know, for the other person, it is like, well, that's wrong for me. I just lost a job. I'm another job.
Right.
Right. So it's so relative. Like, not. I hear people. My friend passed by me. Did not say hi. The teenagers. They really think that it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They really think that it's wrong. I posted this. Nobody liked on it. They really think that's wrong. They take it that. So I just feel, you know, like somebody might say, I didn't eat food for an entire day. I was hungry.
Mm-hmm.
I was left hungry.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get food.
Mm-hmm.
But then what I'm trying to say is what Omar was saying, that you have to see what you have as opposed to what happened to you. Only that will help you to move on. Otherwise, you're going to use the trauma as a defense mechanism, or, you know, not being able to move on or do right things.
Mm-hmm.
You're always going to use that as an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
So, just in the same line what you were saying, like, yes, you didn't get, yes, you lost your job, but think about it. You have education, better education than so many other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can find another job, you have health, you can do that. So, kind of, if you don't think of trauma, as a lifetime trauma, and move on and see what we have, and we can move on, and our life can be better than so many other people.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand war, losing your arms. I can understand that,
mm-hmm.
as a trauma. But these days, it varies what trauma is.
There's no way to argue that there's big and little.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And some events are totally horrific, and some are minor in comparison. So I'm not trying to say they're one size fits all. I'm just saying people suffer. People have bad things happen to them. Loved ones die. And maybe you say, well, I still have other, but I still have this one. Well, okay, but I just lost, you know. So it's having recognition of what you do have. That's a good thing, and that's a positive thing. And just the idea of keep going. Every moment, every breath, I'm going to be here. And then this is because I have nowhere else I can be. And just moving forward in that way. But we get negative events, and so what I'm just trying to say is we understand them, we recognize them. And like you say, you learn, you recognize what you do have, and you can turn to the positive. You can turn to love. You can turn to tasty food, in my example. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you for your talk. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how is love part of our survival instinct.
So,
how is love part of our survival instinct?
Oh, how love is part of our survival instinct.
Yeah.
Well, just as my perspective is people need people. I mean, there's a very simple, obvious one, procreation, right? But it's more than just procreation. It's up there. It's, we're wired that way. And I don't write books on this subject, so I'm not trying to come off as some expert, but I do know that people need people. And even people who are loners, it's usually because of bad events, traumatic events usually in their lives. And so I don't know, I'm not a psychologist, but we can have psychologists cite different studies, and I know that there's literature, so I'm not just making this up. But it's part of our brain. People need to be with other people. And in general, but also very close. We form a relationship with our primary caregiver when we're an infant, usually our mother, but maybe not. And we rely on that primary caregiver for everything, for our life. You know, we're dead without that primary caregiver. And so somehow, as we mature, that gets transferred to another person, to an adult, and you have adult love. And that's psychology that I understand. I believe it's true. I believe it's just built in here somehow. And that's for survival. Thank you. Martha.
Back to the cooking. I thought I had read one time that the monasteries only ate what they was donated to them. So that would be a challenge for the cook all the time to create things that came in on a daily basis that were given them. Versus your idea of worldly, maybe that meant someone who had a choice. They could pick different kinds of foods and be a little bit more selective.
Oh.
But the monastery was just what you got is what you got, what you dealt with.
Well, I don't know exactly. I don't know. Thank you. I don't know how it was then, but mostly in Indian Buddhism, more ancient, they relied strictly on donations, on alms. My understanding, as Buddhism moved into China, there was a movement to more self-sufficiency. So very common on a monastery land, they would grow plants, especially starting in China, and I would presume in Japan. That doesn't mean they didn't accept donations, because I know they did. That's even discussed in Dogen's essay about what happens. He's got a good part of this is detailed instructions. What do you do when a donor comes? You know, you gather these people and you deal with that. So, if I'm answering your question, but I think, this is my opinion, reading Dogen, I like to read him in context, realize he's got wonderful things to say, but he also wrote 800 years ago and he was writing for a different audience than he was writing for us. And so I just interpret it as a kind of an offhand negative comment about the people outside his walls. That's Todd.
After that, and about food, I was just kind of wondering if some of this symbolism of food is metaphorical. That, you know, making food really tasty, in other words, and consuming. It seems like I consume in other ways also. Somebody who puts a lot of effort into music. And I see it in the audience and in myself. I smile and I feel great, you know, which is my ear, I guess, and my eye. And also, just recently, I was just thinking about karaoke, which is maybe closer to what we do here as a ceremony. And in that ceremony, in many instances, it seems to me I've had the food, and because of the ceremony, it tastes a little better. So that's, I think, all I wanted to... I was just kind of wondering if that would be something that maybe broadcast the meaning a little further than just food.
Great. Right. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, you could take it metaphorically. And I should add Dogen. A lot of times when you want to read, if you want to read Dogen, you can consider it that way too. not just in context, but also metaphorically. But you're right. It is a good metaphor for other things, too, not just food. Thank you for pointing that out. Steve.
There's this idea of the metaphor of tasty food, and particularly you were mentioning before about our reaction to trauma. It reminds me of a story you may have heard of about a man who's running for his life with a tiger. And the tiger is gaining on him, but they come to the cliff, and he scrambles over down the face of the cliff. And he's hanging onto a little bush on the face of the cliff. Just barely up over there, and the tiger's up there pacing back and forth and looking down. And the man looks down at the base of the cliff, and the tiger's mate is down there looking up and pacing back and forth. And as he's hanging on this bush, he notices, oh, it's a strawberry bush. And he plucks off strawberry and eats it. Mm-hmm. And it tastes so sweet.
And he lets go. In the moment, that's right. In the moment. Thank you. Anything else? Yes, please.
Thank you for the talk and for bringing up the instructions for the cook. That's a really fun, I guess, metaphor for life, I suppose. But I really like that bit about taking... I forgot what you said exactly, but it was like accepting all like bad ingredients, just like, you know, as well as the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
Because like there's nothing worse than bad produce, you know? If you like get a bad tomato or something, you just want to like chuck it immediately. Mm-hmm. And it's like so inherent, it's just like, it's viscerally revolting. And it actually takes some effort to like be a little more, conservationalist minded with your food.
Mm.
And I suppose it's a similar scenario with your mental ingredients that you've got kind of swirling around.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to discard the ugly ones. So I like that bit. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. We work with whatever we have, right? That's kind of the message. Thank you so much. That's good. Yes, thank you.
I kind of find the concept of taste to be interesting because, you know, when a tenzo is cooking for monks might not really care about the taste. I mean, everything probably tastes great to them.
Mm-hmm.
They probably were not going to say anything bad anyway. You give them, like, just rice and they'll be happy with it, probably, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe taste is, like, part of great tasty food is perception of it, kind of a thing. And it kind of reminds me of the story about Buddha. He just gained enlightenment. He's just walking out. He's kind of hungry because he did he didn't eat much in that process, right? And this poor woman gives him a half-eaten mango, and he eats that and finds it really good, right? You know. So maybe the perception is... It changes, actually. You know, I mean, a while back I went with this detox diet because it was recommended to me go to this detox diet. So for like 4 days I had basically porridge for 4 days, and I was okay with it. At the end of it, you know, you eat porridge, you don't care about food taste anymore, you forget about taste. So you're like, okay, I don't have to worry about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But this diet gets over, and the next day I eat like a piece of bread. That tastes awesome. I've never tasted anything that good. Maybe just a step back. You know, that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you. Yeah, it depends on your thinking. Actually, in this essay, Dogen talks a bit about tastiness. I don't think he uses, it's in translation, right? But he doesn't, the English doesn't say that. But he talks about a fine soup and making it special, and he tells some stories about how he saw one tenzo walk so many miles just to get special mushrooms so that the soup would be really good. So there is some, that aspect in this essay. So anyway, thank you. There's also a story about the king of Lankara, if I remember the kingdom, right? It's one of the old sutras where he donates, maybe it comes from the same story, a half of a mango, which is, if you're living around mangoes, sounds like a very, very small offering. But he did it so sincerely that he was rewarded with great merit and enlightenment. That's the sutra. So it doesn't have to be a big offering, just a little one. Yes.
I was at Green Gulch for a retreat, and the second dinner I was there for, the Tenzo came to our table, because the person sitting next to me was the person in their sangha who was least sensitive to spice, and we were having a curry that night. Mm-hmm. And so she came to see if it was too spicy or if it was okay. And each meal after that, she had kind of a person that she would check in with about the meal for each specific thing and was adjusting the meal to that. And I thought how nice it was that for that sangha, the Tenzo knew her community well enough that for each thing she was doing, she knew to adjust, and that person has a hard time with spicy food, so I'm going to see if that curry was okay. Mm-hmm. And this person likes sweet, so I'm going to see if I put enough sweets out today. And I think it's just a really beautiful thing, creating tasty food where you know the people in your community and what tasty is to them, and you're adjusting. She checks to see if the person who likes spice, if it was enough.
Right.
She left out extras for them that night too.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great example. Wholehearted dedication, paying attention, really giving everything you have to your craft, your effort. I think we're close to 9 o'clock, so it's probably time, if I remember right, first is announcements. Are there any announcements tonight? Yes, please.
Chris made the cookies tonight.
I hope they're tasty. Yes, you might.
So, Catalina wasn't feeling well before she went home. She gave me these announcements to announce. So, Saturday on the 20th, so this coming Saturday, I believe it's the 29th, we don't have any events going on. So we're just going to have our regular Saturday morning sitting and walking meditation and sitting and ceremony and breakfast in the back house, and we do the zendo in the back house like we always do on every Saturday. May 6th is intro to Zen. May 13th, Saturday, Bonnie is doing Buddhism and Society. And May 19th is our monthly Sangha meeting, which will also take place in the back house. And all these events usually take place right after the 9:30 meditation, which ends at 10:10. So everyone's welcome to join. Please come. And if you do have time this Saturday or any Saturday, and your eyes open up, not too early, not too late, but from say 7:30 to 12, if you want to come and help us clean, please join in that too. Thank you.
Any other announcements, Dave?
Yeah, every once in a while we like to remind people of our little boilerplate announcement. Practice at Canando is open to everyone without any fees or any membership requirements. But it is important to remember that since we receive no outside funding at any time, Canando is entirely dependent on the generosity of all of us to sustain its facilities and operations. So please consider supporting Canando in a way that reflects the importance of Zen practice in your daily life.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, since Wilmar mentions that this Saturday we have nothing going on, I'm going to spontaneously call a garden day because the weeds are getting beyond us. So anybody who wants to stay after 9:30 meditation and help out in the garden is welcome to join in. We have tools and gloves and so forth, but wear, you know, sturdy clothing and sun protection, and come and join us for some work. It won't be about an hour's worth of work that we do.
Nothing's supposed to be happening, but the weeds didn't get the memo.
Yeah. So yeah, it's going to be a garden day. I'll send out an email, but some of you may not be on our email list. So but
I just want to say.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other announcements? We do visitors, right? Newcomers next?
Okay.
Yeah. Are there any people who are here for the first time tonight? Would you give us your first name, please?
I'm Brian.
Brian, welcome. Thank you for coming. Anybody else? Why don't we go around and introduce ourselves to Brian?
Brenda.
Garrett.
Eric.
Jeff.
David.
Jason.
Margaret.
Lee.
Scott.
Vasile.
Todd.
Ute.
Todd.
Ken.
Lamar.
Jeanette.
Karen.
Jim.
Anna.
Richard.
Sharon.
Dave.
I'm Chris. Thank you for coming tonight and listening and contributing to the discussion.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it.
with Carolina one. Umar, what did Carolina want? She's got to redo something that isn't broken, right?
I got a new clock.
You did?
Yeah, I just haven't had a chance to bring it in yet.
Just wait till that one gets solid and then we can put the...
No, I'm going to put it right here. I'm going to take this one out because this is just like a real hassle to...